Today on Poolside Genius, we take a look at the Tiger-filled dream match and whether it's a money grab or a momentous occasion. We then shift our focus to competitions of our dreams from sport past and present. And then finally, we select our very own Masters meal, where we are the Masters champions and we select the meal served at the next year's Masters.
This is Poolside Genius, where we always make a splash.
All right, we're in the middle of the summer, and it is a scorcher. There's not really much going on right now in the world of sports, unless you're watching your day-to-day baseball games. But we do have a great idea coming up for us, which is the Tiger Woods-Phil Mickelson dream match that they are starting to speculate about. It may have, they were trying to get it going in July 3rd, but it wasn't enough time to get it there. But it's $10 million, winner takes all. Reams, how do you feel about this dream matchup?
I think it's certainly a matchup that has been overdue. It's been talked about since, I guess, the two guys have played in a practice round in the Masters. I think it's a great idea. It's something that I feel both of them are going to obviously prosper from. But it gives the golf fan, whether you are an intense golf fan or just the novice, an opportunity to see arguably the two major stars in the last 20 years face off in a much different venue.
Now, do you think that it's too late? I think, you know, these dream matches are great, and a lot of times they're just really a money grab because it's people that are usually past their prime, and they're just trying to, you know, kind of hold on to the spotlight and, you know, make a money grab. I mean, $10 million, that's a great day's work.
There's a lot of ways to take a look at this. The way I take it is, Phil, he's a guy that's always looking to make the most in terms of money in regards to whether it's his sponsors or even from what you hear about him on the golf course in practice rounds. He's a huge gambler. He's always got those Nassaus that he's dealing with. So I think if you bring Tiger into this mix, Phil's personality, having them mic'd up, I think it's going to be just a fantastic show.
Yeah, it might be a fantastic show, but I mean, is it really golf? Is it fake sports?
Well, you asked, has it been overdue? I think when they obviously first started getting on tour, there was a specific grudge between the two of them. Phil was a little bit older, a little bit more accomplished. Tiger came on the scene and he was just adamant about really killing everybody. So in regards to your question, has it been overdue? I would say back in their early career, they were just too interested in kicking butt. Is it a money grab? Well, I think the money gives a situation where it allows them to come out of their shell, show their personality, and really have something to play for outside of the realm of, gee, everything has to be staid in golf. It has to be really strict. Here they're going to be able to let their hair down and just have fun.
Now, are we going to play by Phil rules in this, where he just gets to stop the ball if it's about to go off the green, or, you know, is that what's going on there?
Come on now. That Shinnecock course was just brutal. I realize, you know, at that point Phil was just really almost making a mockery of it. But, you know, that course was just – that green itself was lightning. So if he does it in this realm – I think it'll be even better theater.
Well, here's the thing. Everybody's playing on the same course. You blame the course. Oh, the course. You know, golf is one of those things where it gets old when people just blame the course. Oh, the course wasn't in great shape. I mean, and sometimes you see that in your different other sports, but not so much. I mean, besides the Philly AstroTurf at the Vet, you know, I mean, you don't really see a whole lot of complaining about the actual field of play as much as golf. It comes off as whiny and... You know, it's very off-putting, but to get back to our situation here, $10 million, I mean, and you talked about how there was that almost grudge at the beginning of their careers. Now, I'm feeling as though that grudge, they've softened around the edges there a little bit. The edge isn't quite there. Now it's just kind of two buddies playing golf, you know, trying to make the most out of this situation. And, you know, to me, that diminishes it a little bit.
Diminishes it. I think it actually enhances, because I think you pull back the curtain and you get to see how they really might interact. I mean, let's put it this way. Tiger's known for being so aggressive, so focused on being the killer, whereas Phil, he comes across a little bit more likable. I think what this will do, it'll allow people to see Phil's competitive nature, and I think it will also give us an opportunity to see Tiger soften his image a little bit. I think for me personally, I've always been a little bit against Tiger because I've looked or hoped to see him with a little bit softer of an image.
Wait, now, let me get this straight. You want to see one of the world's greatest competitors, one of the greatest golfers of all time, have a softer side and not be aggressive on the course not try to demolish everyone in their path. You can't have it both ways. What, you know, just like all get together and hug and sing kumbaya? Like,
no, not at all. What I'm hoping, though, is I'd like to see Tiger have some fun, share some laughs with Phil. A shot gets messed up, you can laugh about it. Or, you know, you start to see some of the head games. But also to see Tiger open up a little bit, because when you watch him on the course, I'm not going to say he's definitely just a robot, but very rarely does he get out of his own focus.
I feel like lately he's not been as intense on the course. I think he's kind of, I don't know if he's mellowed, if he's come to grips with it, the inevitability of Father Time catching up with him, the injuries, the knee, the back, you know, any mental stress that's, you know, been taken on him. But here's my thing. We haven't seen that intense Tiger anymore, and maybe he doesn't even have it in him anymore. And to me, that diminishes the actual entertainment value. I want to see that guy with the killer instinct that is just going to demolish the opposition and, you know, try and go for the jugular right away, as Tiger did early in his career. And I think, again, this is going to be more of a show than competitive golfing. And, you know, it's nice, you know, the hype is going to be huge, but I just don't think the actual event itself is going to provide us with that kind of competitive nature. I think it's, again, two friends hanging out, playing golf, you know, for the world to see, and, you know, hey, somebody's going to make $10 million off of it. Great. But
I take the total different side of that coin. I think, like, Tiger's always going to be competitive. You're right. Since he's come back, I think he's softened his nature a little bit. I think recognizing that golf is really in the hands of all these young guns, and if you watch these young guns, whether it's Spieth or Justin Thomas, they're all buddies. Ricky Fowler, they're all pulling for each other off the course. Rarely have you seen that in the past. I think Tiger has seen that, and it has certainly brought a different dimension to his focus. I think the other part of it is, and this is where Phil comes into play, the whole mess with the Ryder Cup the last two rounds, I think Phil being very vocal and getting Tiger, or at least recognizing how important Tiger's role as an assistant coach was, I think that really opened Tiger's eyes towards giving back, not just to the game, but giving back to his competitors, being more of a support. He had that opportunity, and I think that really added to his change. I think in this case, it's going to peel back the layers, and you'll see how they get along. Is it going to be a show? Absolutely. But I think that's good for golf.
I think it's canned. I think that it's... I'm not into the softer side of golf. Oh, look at these guys. They're having a great time. You know, if I wanted to see that, I'd go out on the links with any of my buddies. Reams, it's not...
But this is something different.
I mean, do you enjoy watching the All-Star games?
No, I don't. Not the All-Star games.
So All-Star games are exhibitions, right? And during these exhibitions, everybody's buddy-buddy. It's not like the old days where, you know, people were sliding into home plate, you know, barreling over catchers. And now we have, oh, you know, hey, it's my buddy.
But with Phil and Tiger, the difference here is, and hopefully there's been talk, yeah, it'll be $10 million. $10 million, winner gets it all. But it'd be interesting if each of them put up two of their own, $2 million of their own cash. Be great to just put it right there on next to the green, next to 18. Everybody's seeing it. Or maybe they get into a situation where it's bringing back the Skins game. Can you imagine bringing then these younger guys into an avenue of another Skins match? I think it would be fascinating. I just like to see them interact. You rarely see that in golf. You go and watch the NFL Pro Bowl. Yeah, you see them clowning around, but they're all making pretty much the same amount of money. They're all guaranteed money. They're over there in Hawaii or Florida hanging out for the week. It's brutal. It's unwatchable. The NBA All-Star game, same thing. It's just a bunch of guys playing pickup. This isn't what this $10 million winner-take-all is going to be. I think it's going to be much more fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know. Will it be entertainment? Will it drive ratings? Absolutely. I think you'll get all of those things. But I just, it's like, you know, and I want to use this comparison. It's kind of like the WWE, where they'll bring back Hulk Hogan or some old wrestler that hasn't wrestled in years, or when The Rock would come back after 5-6 years away, just to get a cheap pop, get everybody excited. And then they would have a match and you'd be like, wow, that was lame. That was boring. And I mean, and that's scripted. I mean, this isn't even, you know, scripted.
But here's the thing: between these two, there's history. There's a definite edge in their history between each other. I think being able to see them mano a mano, it's fascinating. And yes, has it softened a little bit? Have they become buddies a little bit? Maybe, maybe not. But to me, I'm gonna just grab a hold of it, and I'm really looking forward to hopefully seeing this occur.
Now, beside the entertainment value, beside whether it's actually going to be truly entertaining and competitive, who do you have?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm going to be rooting for Phil. I'm a, you know, to me, lefty's a guy I've always gravitated towards because of his demeanor. I think his way of attacking a golf course, he's always gone for every shot. For most times, it's gotten him in trouble. I mean, you're talking about the current 20th ranked golfer. I'm going to be thinking his consistency over the last, even these last 10 years, I think is going to give him an opportunity to compete, to do well. It wouldn't surprise me, though, if, you know, he's coming down on 18 and he's up a stroke and he hits an awful fade and it's costs him the whole thing. That would be typical Phil.
All right, fanboy Farinelli.
Ouch.
You know, you're coming at it like you like a little schoolgirl. You know, you're happy, you're excited, you know, you're a big fan of Phil. Well, let's look at it from the actual ability side. I mean, I think that, you know, again, Tiger, his last major was in 2008, the U.S. Open. He was second in the PGA in 2009. He's had, you know, a laundry list of injuries, you know, significant injuries. He's had a lot of time off. He's had personal turmoil. He's currently ranked 69 in the world, you know, way, way further back. His last win was at the Bridgestone Invitational in 2013. But to me, this type of event is where Tiger will rise to the occasion. Tiger has that competitive nature, and we've seen him soften, but you know what? I think he can kind of sense blood. I mean, he knows how Phil gets in pressure-packed situations. Phil can kind of crumble and wilt a little bit, you know, and again, we will see Tiger come back. I've pretty much, buried Tiger for the last, you know, probably 10 years at least, you know, saying he was done, it was over. But I think in a matchup with Phil, I think he's going to be the one that wins. And, you know, again, I'm more of a Phil fan myself, but I'm going against the grain, and I'm going to say that Tiger will come out on top.
Well, you're probably sitting there thinking that Tiger's going to play the head games. I think it comes down to coming off the tee. You got to give the advantage probably to Tiger. If Phil can find the fairway on a consistent basis, I think that keeps him engaged, keeps him hopefully on the straight and narrow. I think the short game is going to obviously lead towards Phil. I think on the greens, obviously, you're going to take a look at can Tiger putt consistently. If that happens, maybe you lean towards Tiger if that occurs, if he can putt consistently. Obviously, it depends what course they pick to play. But to me, the question comes, Phil getting off the tee, Tiger finishing on the greens. That, to me, that's going to probably determine it beyond all the head games, which will be fascinating.
When they get to the 18th and say it's tied, are we going to have like a Rocky Apollo Creed hold both hands up at the end, or do you think they'll go into, play extra holes?
Oh, they'll go extra holes. They got to figure it out. For $10 million?
What if they just say, hey, I'll take five, you take five? How much of a letdown would that be? Or would that be an even better play for them to stage a second match? You know,
I'm telling you, there will be people that will want more and more of this type of event. Agreed. Win or lose, it's gonna build. I think it's a great idea. They'll figure out the winner.
And the best way to establish this is to, again, eventually get guys that are in their primes.
Oh, it'd be fascinating with getting Spieth or Dustin Johnson. Absolutely. In our last segment, for all you golf fans, unfortunately for all you golf fans, my boy Bender was pretty sour on watching the show of Phil versus Tiger for that big $10 million. It got me thinking, what dream matchups could we come up with from other sports that we would really like to see? And with the caveat that it could be from any era. So initially, since my boy Bender here is a big 49ers fan, I right away think about the GOAT, Jerry Rice. So I picture Jerry Rice going out, lining up as a flanker, and all of a sudden meeting up with him from the Raiders, Lester Hayes, filled with all that stickum, playing a man-to-man. It's a matchup I would love to see. Could flip it forward, very similar type of cornerback to Mr. Stickum would be Richard Sherman. I would love to see those two matchups against Rice and how the GOAT would fare on it. Bender, you being that 49er fan, what do you think?
Oh, I definitely think Jerry Rice would do extremely well. I mean, he dominated some of the best competition in the world. I mean, Deion Sanders, universally known as perhaps the greatest cover corner of all time. Jerry Rice had very favorable statistics when he played Deion's teams. Now, again, it's very hard to use statistics based on this because, a lot of times Jerry Rice was moving around the field. It's not really as much like today where people would kind of just be at one spot, especially, Bill Walsh and, Mike Shanahan, Mike Holmgren. They would definitely move Rice around to get advantageous matchups. There weren't quite as many statistics available there. But Jerry Rice would have no problem dispatching of Richard Sherman. Again, Sherman, perhaps one of the best cover corners of his era. Again, well, I say cover corner, but again, he was, he's played zone, that bail technique, in that Pete Carroll system. But Sherman, his physicality doesn't really ring true when looking at the players that Rice played against in the 80s. The rules were different, right? Ever since Peyton Manning's receivers got mugged by the New England Patriots that year in the playoffs, the rules have changed, and now Sherman looks like a super physical corner compared to that was just the average cornerback play at that time in the 80s and 90s.
So what you're saying, Sherman and that's Seattle secondary got away with a lot of physical play. It certainly has changed now. Interesting. Who picked them up?
The San Francisco 49ers.
Good luck with that. Anyway, the interesting thing, why I bring up Lester Hayes, if I could go back to that matchup, I always remember those Raiders. On the other side would be Mike Haynes. Correct me if I'm wrong. I remember they were just matching up man-to-man. wasn't really those situations where you're throwing these exotic Ds out or one cornerback would stay on one side. Maybe they did stay on one side with Haynes and Hayes. But me picturing, you know, that Stickum just dripping off of Hayes and then getting his, having his hands get on Rice, you think that that would have any sort of effect?
Jerry Rice would beat him off the line on the quick slant and take it down the middle of the field for 60.
Yeah, but remember, are we now, what era are we playing in? You know, is Rice able to get off without, you know, having those cornerbacks mug them down the field? Back then, Lester Hayes had that ability to get his hands. My argument is he might have gotten his hands on Rice and possibly made a dent on that.
Yeah, getting his hands on him, he would have needed all that Stickum to try and stick to Rice. I just think Rice had faced better competition. I mean, you look at the Darryl Greens, the Deion Sanders, you know, Rod Woodson, those types of corners at that time. And again, they're all Hall of Famers, but I just think that those corners were much, much better. And obviously, Jerry Rice is the GOAT for a reason.
Well, outside of Woodson, the other two you mentioned weren't necessarily the most physical corners. Now, if you allowed them to play, you know, my argument is maybe you have a way of slowing down the GOAT. However, you know, I'm a big GOAT fan. You know, certainly I'm surprised, of course, you as that Niner fan would certainly see it that way. But flip it to another sport. What do you think?
All right, I'm going to go with baseball. And this is one that I'm kind of a little giddy about. We have the splendid splinter, Ted Williams, facing off against perhaps one of the toughest lefties of all time, the big unit, Randy Johnson. I mean, if you just look at nicknames, this is a great matchup to start off with.
Would the splinter be bailing out like Kruk, you think?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, I don't know that that the splinter has seen the slider that Randy called Mr. Snappy from anyone in his time period. But just a few stats to kind of start us off here. The splendid splinter with a 123.1 WAR. He had 521 home runs. His OBP was 482, and his career average was 344. Randy, obviously 300 game winner. Fantastic pitcher, significant amount of strikeouts, you know, some Cy Young awards, World Series victories. I can't think of many better matchups than this.
Yeah, I would love to see the splinter in there. You know, my thought is he could handle the curveball. He was one of those earliest hitters that certainly could catch up to off speed.
Johnson didn't throw the curveball. He threw the slider.
I realize that. What I'm saying is being able to decipher different pitches, get on top of the different speeds. I don't think there's many people that are going to be better than the splinter. However, throwing that slider going away from Ted, I would hope that he'd lay off. I don't know, that would be kind of difficult.
Well, you know, let's look at this. Ted Williams in his career, he had a lot of variance not too much variance, but he had some struggles with lefties. 1960, he hit 224 against them. 1958, 227. 1946, 244. Now we have a few differences here. In 1956, he hit 387. 1941, he hit 420. And 1948, he hit 371 against lefties. So we see some variance. I mean, 3 years out of his career were, you know, strongly associated with hitting lefties well. We take a look at Randy, on the other hand. Now, this is, I think, probably the best comparison that we could probably make for the splendid splinter in terms of, another similar pure hitter. Tony Gwynn against the big unit went 1-for-12 with 4 Ks. I mean, I don't know, if Tony Gwynn's going to struggle against the big unit, I think that would certainly, be indicative of what Williams would be up against.
Gwynn was certainly a disciple of the way Ted Williams certainly looked after hitting. I think you kind of hit it pretty much on the head there with those stats. I think Ted would probably struggle, relatively speaking.
Yeah, and again, so I definitely think Randy in his prime is going to probably, say they have, we go 10 at-bats in front of the bright lights. I think Randy's probably going to do well. Probably about, he might win the matchup probably 8 out of 10 times, I would guess. You know, the Splendid Splinter is going to get his hacks in, but, you know, I highly doubt that he's going to have overall huge success there.
How about any other sports? One of the sports that we can certainly try and break apart is basketball. Any one-on-one matchups you can think of?
Actually, you know, the art of the big man, it's kind of changed and morphed over time, but two guys that I want to see go head-to-head, the Diesel, Shaq, versus Wilt Chamberlain.
The Big Dipper, you're thinking. I mean, today you certainly wouldn't see those matchups. The game has obviously changed, but if you put them one-on-one, interesting matchup. They were very similar players, especially with their deficiencies at the free throw line. You're talking about both players pretty much low 50s percentage-wise from the free throw line, but in terms of the field, they were both mid-50s. Actually, Shaq was 58% from the field. So their matchups, Wilt, if you're looking straight stats, Wilt averaged somewhere around 30 points a game. Shaq was a little bit less, probably sharing the ball, obviously, with number 24 from Lower Merion.
Actually 8 at that time, but
okay. If you want to get technical here, thank you. In terms of rebounds, though, Wilt, by far, dominated the glass.
He was playing against guys that were like 5'10".
Good point.
You know what I mean? It'd be like, you know, me going against Yao Ming. You know, there's no chance.
I agree with you. I think it'd be great to see. I think Wilt would probably be possibly a little bit more nimble. I think Shaq would try and power him. In terms of straight defense, let's face it, when Wilt wanted to put his mind to something, he usually accomplished it.
How would he be able to drive to the basket on Shaq, the Diesel? I mean, my God, what was he, 320?
Well, Shaq certainly wasn't the greatest defender, especially in terms of effort, but when he put his mind to it, he usually amped it up a little bit. My point is, Wilt, if you take his overall skill, I think he would find a way to be able to be successful against Shaq. I think it would be a great matchup, a very even matchup. I think Wilt would certainly not dominate with his little finger rolls, but he'd be looking possibly to square up. Shaq would be obviously dealing with just straight power.
Yeah, it would be fascinating to see, you know, one-on-one. And it would almost be like, you know, that Rocky Apollo Creed rematch. Fantastic.
Could you imagine how many people would pay to see that one-on-one, though? Would that be such a show? Or would they just, you know, let's make it a free throw contest like what you're saying Phil and Tiger are doing?
Well, it would certainly be more entertaining than what Tiger and Phil are doing, you know, especially if you can use the time machine and get them, you know, in there while they're still in their peak primes.
Totally, totally wrong. You just got me totally, totally disagreeing with you.
Would you say that you're flabbergasted?
Not to that extent, because I'm pretty sure I know this is dead on. Phil and Tiger will be a great watch.
I'm flabbergasted by that.
In today's episode, we've focused on dream matchups, especially off of the heels of a potential Mickelson versus Woods golf match. We've heard Bender here go against the thrilling aspects of this. You sure I can't change your mind on that?
Hey, I'm going to tune in. I'm going to watch it. I'll probably even be amused and entertained by it, but it's still not prime Tiger, prime Phil. So, you know, there's still a little bit of me that wishes that would have happened back in the day. But
I might have to let you off the hook on this one, but to me, it kind of gets me to think you've been hitting your head on the shallow end of the pool again. But we're talking about two players here that multiple Masters wins, one a three-time winner, the other one a four-time winner. One of the neat things I think about the Masters is that if you're a champion, you get to come back the next year and come up with whatever food you want on the menu for the champion's dinner. So we got to thinking, if we had that choice, if we had that opportunity, what would we have on the Augusta menu? What do you think, Bender? What do you think you would like to see?
Well, you know, there are a lot of great choices out there, you know, a lot of favorites. But I'm going to go with some of my very favorite things from La Abuela, a nice little place in on Penn Avenue. You know, I love Mexican food. It's probably my absolute favorite food. I would eat it every single day if I possibly could. But I'd probably start off with Nachos a la Diabla. And they have, you know, it's a spicy nacho with shrimp. Love it. Fantastic. Have a little bit of black bean soup, another fan favorite of mine. And I would finish it off with the always delicious carnita burrito. Again, top notch. Always a fantastic meal. Never a letdown.
Sounds good. I can certainly attest. You've taken me there a couple times with all of our buddies. It's a great place. I got to thinking what I would put on the menu. I could easily go back to my roots, my South Jersey roots, ask a certain restaurant to cater a sub shop called Sacco's. But I'm going to move a little bit towards the west of Jersey into the great realm of Philadelphia.
Well, I wouldn't say that that's west Jersey. I would. There's a clear line there between Jersey and Philly.
They're,
you know,
all
what
the
I mean?
Same.
No,
come
no
on.
It's very different.
They're together. No, you live in South Jersey. You identify with Philadelphia. Anyway, I digress. What I would start on my menu, I'd have roasted peppers, some olive trays, a little bit of bruschetta as the appetizer. But then what I'd have on my menu is I'd have sandwiches from Tony Luke's. Straight from Philadelphia, South Philly. The roast pork with sharp provolone, with Robbie. Maybe even have a side dish of Rob. Fantastic. And then I top off the whole meal with cannolis and Italian cookies. That's what I would have.
So Tony Luke's. You chose Tony Luke's out of all the places. Why? What made Tony Luke's the choice for you?
When I first got to Tony Luke's, the first time I was there, I had a chicken cutlet with Rob and sharp provolone. Fantastic. It actually took them a little bit longer to actually make it. If you ever go to Tony Luke's, it's like you got to know your order. You got to say it quick, else they're just chirping in your ear saying, get the heck out of here. You got to be ready. It's not, you don't mess around when you get down to South Philly. But over time, I stayed away from the cheesesteaks there. Their roasted pork sandwiches, their chicken cutlet sandwiches, to die for.
Excellent. Sounds like a great choice.
Absolutely. Sitting by the pool talking about food certainly gets us warmed up to heading over to La Abuela's. We'd like to thank everybody for listening to our episode today. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any information coming out of the Poolside Genius. Also, 5-star reviews, quite welcome.
And remember, when you're poolside, always dive in the deep end.
Splash.